The following is a recording of the Paul Tedrick August National Content Call with the American Hospital Association on Tuesday, August 12, 2014, at 11 o'clock a.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have all of our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given as to the procedure to follow if you would like to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Ashley Hoffman. Ms. Hoffman, you may begin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our August National Content Call for OnTheCusp.Cotty. So excited to have you with us on today's call, which is going to focus on culture change. Before we begin today's presentation, just a quick reminder that this call is a webinar, so please be sure to log in through that webinar link in order to see the slides today. We'll also post a copy of the slides and the recording to the project website later this week. We have two presenters today. The first is Linda Green, who's the Infection Prevention Manager at Highland Hospital in Rochester, New York. Linda has over 25 years of experience in infection prevention and has authored or co-authored several peer-reviewed publications in nursing and infection prevention journals, textbook chapters, and implementation guides. Linda serves as the national faculty for the CUSP-CAUTI program and was editor for the recently released APIC-CAUTI Implementation Guide. Also with us today is Jenny Tuttle. Jenny has over 25 years in the critical care units at the Tucson Medical Center and Duke University Center with a focus on neuro and neurosurgical nursing. She was the team lead for On the Cusp Stop CAUTI project in the neuro, medical, and surgical ICU. As the clinical nurse leader for this unit, she continues to be an active participant in implementing the quality initiative to engage the staff daily and spread success throughout the facility. And now it's my pleasure to turn it over to Linda Green.
Thank you so much, Ashley, and it is a pleasure to be here. I'm just going to go through very quickly some of the learning objectives, which is that we're going to describe the way in which improvement in clinical culture can facilitate efforts to reduce urinary catheter use. I just want to pause 1 second and talk about clinical culture as I go on. But one of the things that we find out, and I've learned this through some of my participation on other CUSP projects, not necessarily CAUTI projects, is that people don't necessarily get as excited about the cultural issues as they do about the technical ones, because sometimes we're just scientific based, and sometimes those cultural issues are, you know, what's new, what have you. But what I've learned, particularly through this work and some of my other CUSP work, is those cultural changes. Those adaptive changes are equally, if not even more important. So trying to get people to do what they need to do and helping us understand that. So I think that's a very important point. We're also going to identify ways in which we can use the HSOPS results and the team checkup tool to identify opportunities for improvement. And I know sometimes it seems like a lot of work. If you're new to the CAUTI CUSP project, you're thinking, oh my goodness. But I can tell you when you do that cultural assessment, it really does help you identify opportunities for improvement. And then finally, I'm going to utilize some case studies to develop strategies to overcome the barriers. And we do know when it comes to decreasing urinary catheter device utilization, there are many, many barriers. But I'd like to start with just getting some background information. So I'm wondering if you could answer this polling question. Obviously, it's very self-explanatory. Are you a state lead, CUSP facility, fellow or mentor, unit champion, or other? So appreciate that if you'd fill that out, and then we'll have the results.
So we'll just give everyone about 30 seconds to respond. All right, and there are the results from our poll.
All righty, so we have a wide variety of people on the phone, which is wonderful. So it kind of helps us. The second question, and before we start, just be interested in your answers to this one. What's your greatest challenge with catheter removal? And certainly that helps us kind of understand and direct some of our comments.
So we still have some responses coming in. Give you guys about 20 more seconds to get your answer in. There's the results.
There's the results. I could have guessed this result, and we'll talk a little bit about that real or perceived, and I see a typo there, so our apologies when we loaded the questions. It's not perceived, it's perceived. But anyways, real or perceived need for accurate INO. So certainly we know that's a challenge, and some of the other things are challenges as well, and probably many of you haven't been given the choice would have said all of these. So let's just get into the basis of the presentation. You know, when you look at it, what is the culture? Well, the culture, as we all well know, it's made up of the values, it's made up of the beliefs, it's made up of underlying assumptions, attitudes, behaviors shared by a group of people. So when you're thinking of culture, culture is the behavior that results when a group arrives at a set of generally unspoken and unwritten rules for working together. And I think, you know, we talk about culture all the time, but those generally unspoken or unwritten rules really are what makes the difference. And if you go into any unit in a hospital, or even if you go out into the community, or you go to a hotel, or you go to a store, there usually is a culture that's somewhat pervasive. And the more that we can understand that culture, the easier it is certainly to intervene and to make changes. And one of the things that was pointed out, there's such a thing as an organizational culture, but there's also such a thing as a clinical culture. And when I talk about clinical culture, that's that set of attitudes and behaviors in a clinical area or patient care unit. And that clinical culture is strongly influenced by leadership, experience, history, and tradition. And one of the things when we think about the clinical culture, and I think if you're working with hospitals, if you're a state lead or what have you, really think about the clinical culture and the organizations you work with if you're a cusp unit. But one of the things we know about leadership is it's the direct providers who provide what we'll call the content of care. But it's leadership which establishes that environment in which care is delivered. And they set the culture, the behavioral standards, and the organizational values. So we can't underestimate the power of leadership. However, understanding what those values are and what those behavioral standards are for leadership is extremely important. So let's look a little bit about urinary catheters, and let's examine the culture of safety in our assessment of harm. And, you know, one of the things in a previous content call, and I think if you don't get a chance, go back and review the slides, but Scott Griffith talked about the fact that culture changes when you move from what we call a rule-based to a value-based culture, when it's because that's what we value. So if you look at safety and harm assessment, first of all, there are three things. People have talked about those three things differently, but I'm going to give you my assessment or my interpretation. First of all, you have to believe that failure to follow guidelines, principles, or what have you may cause harm. Secondly, there's some type of built-in alert. There's something that really kind of alerts you or prevents you from doing harm. And thirdly, there's got to be consequences for failure to implement those types of things. So here's a familiar picture. I'm sure you're all familiar with this, the case of the catheter, and we know that's an issue. So let's go back and let's look at safety and let's look at urinary catheters. And let's take something that is pretty apparent. Let's take seat belts, for example. And if you take the seat belt example, Do people believe in it? Do they believe that if you don't fasten your seatbelt, you could potentially result in harm? And I think we'd say that most of us truly believe that. Now, there are a few outliers. People say, I never wear a seatbelt. But I think the majority of us know that it is the right and safe thing to do. And it becomes a value-based thing. It's second nature for most of us. But if I'm pulling out of my driveway and I'm in a real hurry and I may forget, there's something to remind me. There's that little annoying noise that goes off in my car. And thirdly, and I don't want to emphasize the stick more than the carrot, but there are consequences. For example, you can get a ticket or things like that if you don't fasten your seatbelt. So now let's take the urinary catheter. Do most people believe it causes harm? And I think that's the question that you have to ask yourself when you're doing your organizational assessment. And I would question that. I mean, I think people talk about preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infections, but do they really believe in the fact that having a urinary catheter can cause harm? It can cause clotties. It can cause non-infectious types of events. Patients certainly can try to get out of bed and pull out their catheter. So there's all types of things. Do we have built-in safety alerts? And I know in many hospitals that's one thing they're trying to think of is how can we alert that this path, whether it be automatic stop orders. And finally, are there consequences? And by consequences, I don't necessarily mean negative consequences, but do we give feedback to people? This is an inappropriate insertion, or you didn't follow the nurse-directed protocol, or those types of things. And are there really, some type of sanctions or even just regular feedback related to that? So if you look at patient safety, I would say most of us feel we have not gotten there yet with urinary catheters. Well, there are some clear lessons about culture. This is an article from AJAC, Reducing National Healthcare-Associated Infections, Lessons Learned from a National Collaborative. And if you look at the findings in the Welch article here, it's fostering change, overcoming the barriers. So first of all, we've got barriers. I know a lot of you talked about the fact that accurate INO, whether it's real or perceived, the units that did well had good communication, standardized processes and metrics. They had local focused implementation. So implementation was at the unit level. One of the things I find particularly in large hospitals, and the next speaker, Jenny Tuttle, who will give you some great examples of what she did, is oftentimes when we're studying these projects, we want to go organizationally, which is fine in a small hospital. Sometimes in a large hospital, we really have to kind of take it one step at a time. Frontline staff engagement. One of the things I found, even in coaching calls and working with a number of hospitals, that although we sometimes say we're engaging the frontline staff, we don't always engage the frontline staff. Oftentimes it's leaders who really don't know the day-to-day issues. Opportunities for organizational learning, support, resources, and then, as I said, feedback and reinforcement. So all of those things are really, really important. Well, first of all, I think it's really important that we do a stakeholder assessment. And by that I mean if you're in the ICU and we know urinary catheters are a particular issue in the ICU, and if you've been a nurse like myself for many years, it was pretty typical that every ICU patient had a urinary catheter. So when looking at this, ask yourself, who are the key drivers in your unit? Is it the intensivist? Is it the nurse manager? Is it the MD director? Is it the nurses themselves? And I think particularly if you're looking at an intensive care unit, in different clinical cultures, there will be different people who are clearly the drivers. I worked in an intensive care unit in my last hospital that the nurse manager was the key driver. She had a good relationship. She was well respected. If she said something to the intensivist, they certainly would do it. In other hospitals, intensivists rule the bus, so really find out who are the key drivers. There will be a couple tools, and we'll post them on the website. There are some stakeholder assessment tools that are available. There are some other areas to determine who are your key drivers, and that's really, really important. One of the things to keep in mind when you're doing your organizational assessment, and right now I'm just talking about an ICU culture, but it could be any particular culture. If I'm trying to reduce urinary catheter utilization, how important is it to each one of these people? And there was another analysis, I know when I was in graduate school, it was called the Prince analysis, where you take each one of these people and you'd say, how much power do they have on a scale of 1 to 3? How strongly do they feel about the issue, which is the salience? And then are they either for or against it? And one of the things that you often find is that we usually, by nature, will go to the highest ranking person. And oftentimes, if it's a new initiative, sometimes that highest ranking person is definitely going to be for the new initiative, and they might have a great deal of power. But they're not particularly passionate about it. And sometimes that's because their plate is so full that they just really don't have the buy-in. They're certainly supportive. So when you're trying to just change that culture for removing urinary catheters, kind of think about that. Who are the people? A good example in the hospital I'm in right now, and I know it takes a long, long time to change culture, but we really did start trying to start because we've had a problem with clotties. We tried to start with our surgical arena, at least trying to get to those patients, making sure that obviously patients who had surgery and did not need a catheter didn't have them. And we got a very young, aggressive, passionate orthopedic surgeon who is not necessarily chief of orthopedics. She's very involved. She's very engaged. She led the initiative. And she came to a meeting last week, and she basically said, I have decided since I'm leading this particular initiative that no orthopedic patients are going to have urinary catheters. And she said, I got a lot of pushback from my colleagues, but we decided that's the way we're going to go. So just an example of trying to find those champions, and it's not as obvious as it could be. So let's look at organizational culture. Let's look at the levels of organizational culture. And you really want to look at values which reflect desired behavior but are not reflected in observed behavior. So if I'm doing an organizational assessment, first of all, my underlying assumption is safety is a system property. But oftentimes, particularly with physicians, and this is really hard to change, and I point this out because as you move forward and you really try to change that culture, they think safety is a result of individual competency. In other words, if I'm a good physician or I'm a good nurse, I promote patient safety. But really, patient safety is a property of the system, and it's only through all working together that we can really have a safe environment. So in terms of beliefs and values, you know, the value is teamwork, but again, particularly in medicine, we value autonomy. So think about those discrepancies and where those occur and what you might do to kind of change that. And then finally, in terms of desired behavior, we want people to round to assess catheter appropriateness, but the observed behavior oftentimes is they don't participate in rounds, or the rounds are just kind of another checkbox. So four components of a safety culture, you know, first of all, you look at your reporting culture, whether or not you have a just culture, whether there's flexible teamwork and a learning culture. And that learning culture is so important because that's what really determines high reliability organizations. And I know you've heard a lot about high reliability organizations, but it's important to look at those and then to kind of assess your own culture. So when we look at the cultural assessment, and I know a lot of times people don't get really excited about it, but it is so vitally important. So we want to identify the areas of culture and needs of improvement, increase awareness of patient safety concepts, and then evaluate those, and then do some internal and external benchmarking. And finally, what we're looking at is meeting regulatory requirements and identifying those gaps between believed and observed behaviors. And what you'll find when you really begin looking at your results, that you have a lot of subcultures and microcultures, and sounds like a microbiology thing, but it is quite interesting. So if we're going to apply this to quality, first of all, that those core aspects of the safety culture, so there's the culture of safety, it's communication patterns and language. You know, how do we talk about this? When I think of communication, I see a few people who were part of the fellow program, and one of the things in one of our IACT presentations, Jennifer Meddings, who's done a tremendous amount of work, said, you know, it really boils down to communication, and as the, no matter what process you put in place, it's communication at the bedside. So when you have a culture that there's dialogue about patients, there's dialogue at the bedside about lines and catheters and those types of things, the more you begin to hardwire that culture. There's also feedback, reward, and corrective action practices. And we've heard a lot of examples. I know I heard of one hospital in South Carolina, and a lot of people have done that. It was a small hospital. They put up signs to, quote, exfoliate the patient. And she gave little prizes to people who were, you know, who pulled the catheter in a timely manner and really assessed that. And it may seem simplistic, but in that particular culture, it really did work. Formal and informal leader actions and expectations. And, you know, as I said, when you assess that culture, there's a lot of informal leaders there. And then teamwork processes. What are the processes in place? Do we have mutual support? Those types of things. Do we have the resources? And I've heard a lot of people on coaching calls talk about the fact that we don't have the right supplies, or we are evaluating that. And then finally, how do we do error detection and correction systems? So all these things come into play. So if we're looking at our HSOPs, it's supervisor, manager, expectations and actions, promoting patient safety. It's that organizational learning. It's teamwork within units, communication openness, feedback about errors, the non-punitive response to error, staffing, hospital management, support for patient safety, teamwork across hospital units, and hospital handoff and transition. So a number of things there. There is a presentation in the National Content Calls on HSOPs. I would encourage you to look at that. But one of the things that was pointed out in terms of the national database, and that was based on 2012 and intensive care units, one of the lowest scoring areas was non-punitive response to errors. And I found that very interesting, and that was in an intensive care unit. On the other hand, what usually scores very, very high is teamwork within units, and the national rate was 84%. Now, one of the things that you can predict from looking at this is that it's kind of intuitive. We do a great job. It's everybody else who doesn't do a good job. And so when you look at the HSOPs results, it does help you to look at that. Communication and openness, about 61%. And organizational learning nationally is fairly in the 70s. So all of those types of things will help you as you begin to look at that and then say, okay, now what do I do in terms of my own organization? So let's take this a step further, and let's look at taking those HSOPs results, and let's use those results to leverage change. So here's Hospital X, and as they looked at their greatest opportunities, they found that there was feedback and communication about errors was one of their greatest opportunities, or we could say one of our lowest scoring errors. manager and supervisor expectations and actions that promoted patient safety, hospital management support for patient safety, and teamwork across hospital units. And that is not a surprise. So let's kind of connect the dots now to urinary catheters and say, if I had these results, the questions I ask myself, is management truly engaged? You know, there is a huge difference between permission or acceptance and engagement. And oftentimes what we find is with all the multiple priorities of management that it's really hard. They support these issues, but they're not truly engaged. Do we give routine feedback on appropriateness? And I know, you know, I'll hear rates of appropriateness or what have you, and the question I always ask is, are we giving the providers or the people who are inserting them for inappropriate reasons, are we really giving them feedback? So once, and it's important to have aggregate rates, but you know what? When I receive aggregate rates, it's everybody else who's done it wrong, not me. So ask yourself those questions. Now, are evidence-based guidelines implemented, shared, and incorporated into practice? And one of the things, again, that I find, particularly I'm part of a large university system as well, one of the things that I find, and may or may not be your experience, is the fact that evidence-based guidelines, we look at them. If we're developing bundles or we're developing policies, people have input, they're vetted, people don't like this or that. But then when it comes to incorporating them into practice, oftentimes we don't evaluate the processes. And so part of our challenge is not only whether we're putting into place a nurse-directed protocol or automatic stop order or reasons for catheter insertion. Do we evaluate whether those processes work, or is it just another checklist or just another piece of paper? And then finally, what strategies can we develop to improve or enhance this? The thing I love and the power, I think, of the CUSP and the work that you're all doing, and the real issue is that we're leveraging the power and the wisdom of the frontline staff. So it's really not about what we think. It's about what the frontline staff are telling us is happening on a day-to-day basis. And the question is, what can we do? So little scenario here, and actually this is a scenario that some of you may have seen. We have used it. It was developed by ED nurses. And but this is a hospital that had a problem with teamwork across hospital units. So Nurse ED gives a report to Nurse Med on the medical floor, and she says, Patient A is an 87-year-old woman with cellulitis in her right lower extremity. She arrived from her long-term care facility with fever, inflammation, swelling. She's alert but confused. We started a peripheral IV and antibiotics. She's also complained of nausea and vomited once. We gave her an antiemetic. You ready for her now? Wonderful. I'll send her up with the transport tech. Nurse Med calls back to the ED and 20 minutes later and asks for the nurse. Patient A arrived with drenched linens after she urinated on herself, and then she kept trying to get out of bed, telling us she had to go to the bathroom. Why didn't you put a catheter in her? You told me she was confused. She's going to fall trying to get up. Now, clearly, this is an example of teamwork across units. It's a unit that is saying to the emergency department, I can't believe you didn't put in the catheter. And clearly what's happening in this particular situation is that both of them do not have a shared mental model. So in the ED, we have this initiative, we're trying to decrease urinary catheters, but the nurse on the unit is not fully engaged, and that may be because we haven't done enough work with them, or maybe we sent out a memo and said, hey, this is what's going to happen, or maybe we just haven't done enough work in vetting it with stakeholders. So you can see that your HSOPS results certainly can identify issues. Okay, here's scenario number two, and this is a hospital management support for patient safety. And as it turns out, the surgical unit is not discontinuing urinary catheters despite that a nurse-driven removal protocol is in place. When discussing the issue with the frontline staff, they report that the chief of surgery has created a roadblock despite the fact that the protocol was vetted with stakeholders and it was approved by the MedExec committee. The nurse manager on this unit does not want to make waves and has not made the nurses accountable for following the new protocol. You approach the chief of surgery, but he is not engaged and somewhat hostile, and he tells you that his department, they do not have cookie cutter medicine. So you're looking at this culture, you're looking at a culture where people feel managers aren't engaged, and you're trying to decide, okay, how can I address this? And this is a really, really tough problem. One of the tools I've seen, and when we talk about adaptive or cultural change, I think we have to look at adaptive tools, and we hear about CUSP and we hear about engagement, but I also think there's a lot of literature out there in terms of adaptive strategies. And one of the books, and many of you may have heard it, I know it's been talked about on some calls, but it's Getting to Yes. Now, this book actually was published a number of years ago. It's gone through a few updates to make it more modern with more modern scenarios, but I think it's a great tool. So the first thing you might do in this particular surgeon situation is separate the people from the problem. So disentangle the relationship from the substance. So in other words, yeah, the chief of surgery, he's gnarly, he's grumpy, the nurse manager won't support it. But if you're the nurse manager and you're really worried about that, or depending on whether you're a champion or what have you, disentangle the relationship from the substance. Focus on interests, not positions. So what does that mean? What are we here for? We're here for the patient. So let's work together to see how we can help the patient and work together to find creative and fair solutions. And I think that those are really key questions. So ask yourself, why is the surgeon opposed to the new protocol? Try to find out what he's thinking. Is there a rational reason that this happened? And when it comes to surgeons, just a side story, I was working with a very well-known person in the field of infection prevention who gave me some advice, and he said, you know what, if you're an infection preventionist, you need to make new best friends. We know you see eye to eye with epidemiologists and ID docs, but you've got to try to understand the surgeon and make the surgeon your new best friend. So I've kept that. Is there a rational reason? How might we engage them? And what is the common interest here? Is it patient safety? And then what about the nurse manager? How can we help her to do that? So just in terms of all of these cultural things and putting them together and using tools that will help us to drive that culture, to begin to see change, I love this particular book, too. It's from John B. Cotter, A Sense of Urgency. So plans and actions should always focus on others' hearts as much or more than their minds. And I think that's so important. Behaving with passion, conviction, optimism, urgency, and a steely determination will trump an analytically brilliant memo every time. So as we begin to look at all of these cultural changes, this is a slide that actually came to us. It was presented by Health and Human Services meeting as they're looking at national targets for HAIs. And I thought this really kind of summed it up, because I think this is where we need to go when we think of culture. And if you look on the right side of your screen, our traditional journey has what we call the outside in. We define and then we observe. And we observe for compliance, but what we really want to understand is observation for understanding. And so our traditional journey has kind of been based in manufacturing. We think we have all the answers. Solutions are predefined. They're guided by outsiders. and those directly involved in buy-in. As I said earlier, I came to this hospital about a year and a half ago, and it's been a long struggle to change the culture, but when I was meeting with some of the senior leaders as part of my orientation, you know, one of the things that they asked is that we get the frontline staff engaged, that we vet it with people, because we think we have the solutions, but we don't. So the new journey is an inside-out one, and we observe and then we define. So observe for understanding. So if you take the issue of getting the catheters out, or you take the issue that people need INO, let's try to understand what that is. Is it that they're not getting accurate ISNOs? Is it that we're not getting accurate weights? What do we understand about why providers think they need this, or do they truly need hourly monitoring? So observe for understanding in order to change that culture. And that's our new journey. It's really founded in anthropology. Solutions are uncovered. They're guided by insiders. Remember the power and the wisdom of those frontline staff, and those who are directly involved will create the ownership. So with that, and talking about ownership, I'm really pleased to turn the slides over before the last question. Excuse me. What strategies for catheter removal have you implemented in your organization? So this will be helpful.
So we'll give everyone some time to respond to this question. And just a reminder that we are going to post a recording of today's webinar, the full webinar, along with PowerPoint slides on our project website. We'll have that up probably later Wednesday or early Thursday morning on thecusp.stophai.org. That will be under our content calls. So we've got about 115 responses in. Give everyone a few more seconds to click that button.
And so a number of you have a nurse-driven protocols in the daily rounding. One of the things that I have found and to be mindful of is that oftentimes nurses still feel that they need to ask the physician before removing that catheter. So driving the culture of removal, not just the protocol, and the daily rounding, not making it an exercise in futility, but actually asking the care provider, does this patient need a catheter and what is the reason for that? So with that, I'm going to turn this wonderful presentation that Jenny is going to do for us. Jenny Tuttle is, I've heard her before, and she's really done a lot of work on an ICU team in terms of catheter removal. So I think you'll enjoy her presentation. Jenny?
Thank you, Linda. That was really helpful. It's taking those principles you talk about and certainly applying them at the bedside, and that's where I've obviously done most of my work. It's funny, I look at this, my title, a success story. I really should change it more to an ongoing challenge to reach success, because we don't feel we've met, we've made improvements, absolutely, but it's a constant challenge and engagement with the staff. But this is just a little bit of our story for all of you. I know you're about halfway through your program, but my team, when I was the team leader during this process on our unit, I was the unit manager, and I also came from the trenches, having worked at the bedside for over 20 years, nights and days. So I had a very good relationship with my staff, and I was kind of the bossy know-it-all, but that's an ICU nurse for you. So we all know the challenges ICU in particular have, because there's a real culture there, and a lot of our work was trying to crack a little bit of that culture and getting them to think about, no, they don't all have to have a catheter. That's a real big challenge we had. So, again, getting over the personality of the ICU nurses, too. And if I could change, these people can change. Something went back on here. I got excited on that button, I guess. There we go. Thank you. So just a little bit about our hospital, just to give you a reference point, because we all typically want to compare ourselves. We're like, well, we're a big hospital. What are they doing comparing those rates to my rates or their challenges? But we're a 611-bed hospital. Before we built our new orthopedic tower, we're the largest single-story hospital in the country. We have 8 miles of hallways here at TMC, but we tacked on a little bit of a four-story hospital orthopedic area, so took that notoriety away. But the unit we started our program on was, and this was about almost 2 years ago, was specifically a single ICU unit. We It was a 16-bed unit. It's a, again, neurosurgical, medical, pulmonary, vascular surgery, and general surgery. We met all of those. We had two primary adult units. Our other unit is all CVICU and cardiac medical ICU. So that's where we're coming from. And a little bit of our journey here is where we went to, and that's, of course, as you guys have already started and have already done and developed your teams, but it is making sure we developed our team from people that had respect from their peers and can actually influence their peers. Because one of the things we learned is you know, a lot of hospitals, as I've talked to and gone to some of these programs here with working on our CADI project, is a lot of these the drivers are infection control people, and they're not the bedside nurses. And that's one thing we found is really helpful is having the nurse as the lead and really pushing the team from primarily as nurses. It really made a bigger difference and an impact because their peers are telling them what to do, not another department telling them what to do. So I picked two night nurses, two day nurses, my educator, and we were able to hit the staff from both sides on both shifts. And that was very important because a lot of it got done at night, too, besides just during the day. Again, all shifts represented. We have a PCT on our team. But what we did is we also, early on, is embrace the audit process. And that was customizing a tool to evaluate for deficits. I'm going to click forward real quick here. We actually took the audit tool that we took from our cost project and we customized it to our needs. And we really were able to identify areas in which we did not have standardization. For example, when we started looking at where were the catheters placed and did we have a seal intact, and we discovered that all of our ER patients that were placed in ER were coming up without seals intact. So we were able to make a household-wide change, actually, and make sure we had all closed systems put in with durometers. It was a little bit more expensive for our ER patients coming to us because they didn't always come to the ICU, but it was a decision our administration had in supporting our whole project, and that it was worth the extra money to make sure that we did those little things to reduce our CADI rates. So we really embraced the audit tool and expanded it and tried to look for the deficits in areas in which we can improve and standardize as best we could. And we also look at our patients vented. If you can see, there's one section. We wanted to know how many catheters are on our vented patients. And clearly, the standard was if they didn't have a catheter when they came to the ICU, we put a catheter in. That's just the rules were in the ICU. But as we start working on our project, we're trying to drive to get these catheters out of our vented patients. So I'm going to go back a slide here. So customizing our tool and identifying barriers and starting to find areas in which we can start working on the ICU mentality of, okay, maybe we don't need that catheter in these kind of cases. As we got our CADIs through our process, we certainly isolated the root causes, what could we do better, review the practices of nursing, again, other areas we can find for improvement. But we also did is we identified a vent patient population that maybe we can really make our impact because we're a very busy high acute ICU. We do CRRT. We have balloon pumps, CABGs. We're one of the top neuro centers here in Tucson. So we do everything except basically transplants at our facility. So we deal with a lot of vented, very, very sick patients. So this is the group we were trying to, which ones can we take these out of because we have so many vented patients. The other thing we did as part of our journey was collaborating with our other departments. Linda brought up the emergency department example. And that's one thing we identified was changing that mentality where you better put that catheter in. But as we worked through ER, again, changing our product line and getting it more in line with what our needs were, but we also looked at their utilization. They had a team looking at their Foley utilization. And our ER has done a tremendous job as well. They went from a 12% insertion rate to patients moving to inpatient to a 4% insertion rate. And no longer do we question them about putting a Foley in. We're like, okay, great. And then we strive not to put a Foley in even more because the challenge is you put that Foley in and then it just gets passed from department to department until finally someone takes it out. So the quicker we get it out, or better yet, not put in at all, then it's even better for the patient to reduce that risk for sitting in there for days and days and days and people not realizing to take it out. We also work with the operating room. We're trying to look at identify some short OR patient times that we could not put catheters in, working with our transportation, as you saw the dangling catheter over the top of the stretcher, working with them, making sure they keep following the bundle, the Foley bags below the wheel, below the bladder, excuse me. We looked at our MRI and our CT scanners. We found that there were no hooks to keep the catheter bag below the patient, so we're working on adding those in. But most importantly is that nursing unit and providing them with the tools and supplies in which to meet our goals, and that's reducing our utilization and certainly our CADI rates. So So real quick, moving on here. One of the things we looked at, again, with our team as we were getting our CAUTIs and trying to, the constant answer was as we were doing our daily rounding, and I'm telling you, it's our daily rounding that's really made the biggest impact. We've had a nurse-driven protocol here, and Epic-based is our software foundation here, but we've had a nurse-driven protocol for years, well before we ever started this, but we never saw a reduce in our utilization or CAUTI rates at TMC. So we've had this EMR-based protocol. It's been approved by our medical executive committee. Okay, you can take your catheter out if you meet this criteria, but it never made a difference. So those daily conversations you started having in the ICU of, okay, why do you need it? The constant answer we're getting is, well, they're vented. So that's why we decided, well, this is where we can work on. So what we did is okay, well, let's look at the patients who really, really, really need a catheter, and let's look at the ones that maybe we can take them out. So certainly we acknowledge the ones, the sepsis patient, you're doing all your fluid resuscitation for the first 24 hours. Yes, that's reasonable. We'll leave them in for the first 24. CRRT patients, we want the accurate measurement. But even then, I'm starting to question that. And I have to admit, one of our biggest pushbacks is our nephrologists. They want to leave them in, but a lot of these patients are anuric or so minimal, we can bladder scan them. So I'm starting to push back a little bit on our CRRT patients about getting those out, because truly, that there is a real reduction with some of those patients in their output. Acute renal failure, pressors with titration, therapeutic hypothermia patients, absolutely going to watch that. Balloon pumps, if you're not familiar, balloon pumps, the first part, the quickest way you can assess that a balloon pump has shifted in the body is it shifts down, blocks the renal flow, and then we have a reduction in urinary output. So that's really important to keep an eye on them. Then you have your subarachnoid hemorrhages, pardon the acronyms, with cerebral salt wasting, a syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone release, and diabetes and sepsis. Those are all conditions you have to watch urinary output. And then when we do triple H therapy on those patients. And then Lasix drips. Again, so again, we said if that patient meets those criteria, we won't even question why you have a Foleon. But let's talk about the patients we can take them out on. And those are the ones which is maintenance fluids. They're tube feeding. They're already trached and pegged, ready to move to an LTAC. Minor pressors. They could probably get out of bed, use bedpans. So we really started pushing those nurses to take those catheters out, and we've seen a lot of success because what it boiled down to is we never gave these patients an opportunity to be continent because they always had catheters. What we're finding is, wow, you know, they can use a call bell. We can put them on a bedpan. We can get them out of bed if they're doing pretty well in a bedside commode. So we never gave them a chance, and by giving them a chance now, we're actually seeing that we can get these catheters out. So it's been a real move for our nurses. Again, providing the tools, it would boil down to it. The nurses just want to be able to do their job quickly and efficiently without less hassle. And Foleys are convenient. And that's the continual battle we struggle with them it's easier. We don't have the staff to clean the patient. So what we did is, well, let's look at the supplies that we can provide to those nurses. And again, our executive team has been very supportive of this. So one thing, Accurate INO certainly came up early on is, we can't measure. What we did is we bought scales. And we literally went on Amazon. We didn't have to buy the $1,000 scales. We bought infant scales, and we had them PM'd by our biomed department, and they were basically nice little infant scales we could put our chucks on, and we could weigh. And we did some comparisons. We actually poured water on some of these chucks we have, and we bought some premium chucks, the higher end that are absorbent ones. That was, again, a part of our process here as we let the nurses give their feedback on what worked best for them. And we found there was pretty much within 30 to 50 feet enough. And nurses were quite creative. If they were incontinent onto, let's say, the extra linen, they would just bring the whole linen in. They'd zero it out with old linen, clean linen, and put on the soiled linen. So it works great, the scales. I will tell you, if you don't have a bladder scanner in your facility, that is also a huge benefit, too. As we pull these Foleys, we need to make sure there's not having urinary retention. We use ours all the time. I would certainly advocate that would help your nurses work through the patient's need for capping or catheters, and if they're removing them adequate in a good time, that they might not need one back. Because we do pull catheters on patients, we bladder scan them, and we do have an opportunity. If they just can't do it, they retain their urine, we'll straight cap them three times. If they're still high, we'll leave a catheter in. So we take these catheters out, and sometimes we have to put them back in. But again, we're giving the nurses the tools in which to assess these patients, and it makes us feel a little bit more in control of what we're doing. External devices, of course, males are always easier. They have external plumbing. Let's not kid ourselves. It is much easier. Women are challenging. Most of our CAUTIs are women, that continues to be a challenge for us. But we've had those conversations with the team of what can we do to change it on those patients to get that catheter out but able to measure them. And one of those another culture change is, you know, we never use briefs in an ICU, for God's sakes, because, you know, that's nursing home. You know, that's not what we do in a hospital. But with the improvement in our the briefs and chucks we have, really, it's become a very viable option for us. And put them in a brief. We check them every hour or 2 hours, and we can measure that output. So we're actually pushing those a little bit. And like I said, that would have never came up 10, 20 years ago. But it really is an alternative that we can have and still contain the patient, keep them somewhat clean, and get those catheters out. Daily conversations. When we worked on our initial project, you know, those happened every day for 6 months, daily conversations. And we backed away as we're working on a sustainment. And sustainments, let's face it, that's the hardest. And that's what we're certainly seeing our challenges. So we're engaging those conversations again because we did go back up a little bit on utilization, and I'll show you that in a second. But it is very important because the nurses, I hate to say it, almost have to be reminded, okay, let's stop and think about that. I mean, trust me, they know when I start walking around, oh, it's Jenny, and she's going to ask about catheters. But fortunately, it's not just me, but I'm there, and they know, and they're thinking about it more and more and more, and they know it's a very important goal we have to reduce these cottage and utilization. Engaging the staff, again, it's back to those conversations of challenging the status quo. It's not okay to have a catheter in every patient. We don't really need a catheter in every ICU patient. But it also is giving them an opportunity for feedback because you have to make them a part of the process. You just can't dictate. And I think that's some of the challenges I know infection control departments have. Ours did years ago when they wanted to start getting our catheters out. It never was bought in by nursing. And it is now since they're more a part of the process. Let's see, moving on. So it is rewarded behavior. Linda mentioned there was a facility that gave out prizes. Well, the first month we went with no cotties. And the reason we picked our unit was we had 2 to 3 cotties on an average a month. We were the highest cottie rate in our hospital, so that's why we were picked. The first month we went with no cotties, infection control gave us a cake. Not very exciting, but it's acknowledging it. We also gave out change, and it's a little plastic. It literally looked like those things. And every time a nurse took a catheter out, I gave them a little coin, and that coin got them potato chips or a cookie or a soda in the cafeteria. Now, that didn't meet our living well goal for employees, but we didn't care. It was trying to reinforce, even as small as it was, that, hey, you are making a difference. But now we focus primarily on our updates and letting them know, like, for example, we went, July we had no cotties. We had a little bit of a bump in the last months before that, and I have a big board listing the cotties that we've had and trying to reinforce that these are people and these are things, and it does affect those individuals. That's why we're trying to get these out. Here's our utilization rates during our process. When we started, we were pretty much an 89 to 92% utilization rate in ICU for years. We started our program in April of last year, and we dropped immediately. And like, oh, piece of cake, this is an easy process. Kind of took our eyes off the ball. We used the audit tool. I got a little bit lax with the audit tool. The conversation slowed down, and boom, we went back up again. So it just shows you just have to always focus on this, and it's a constant challenge. So, again, back to the daily conversations, and you'll see our utilization. We never expected to hit utilization of 50 to 60% because we do have sick patients. We do have patients that need catheters. So the fact that we hit 30s and 40s just floored us, and we're pretty excited about that. And then we had, as you can see, we have a little bit of a bump up. So we know what works. So it's getting back to, all right, we're seeing that rise again. And it is that constant reevaluation you have to do and looking at your data and say, okay, it's time to refocus again, a little bit of reminder out there. So, again, this is an ongoing process. I would love to say that, like I said, we've succeeded and solved this. We haven't. In fact, it's funny, the unit, the 450s unit, the one we started this pilot project on, I told my staff, if you can go 3 months without a cotty, which we never, ever even got 2 months without a cotty, I buy them lunch, and I got them looking at it, and sure enough, we went 3 months without a cotty. What I got bogged down with is our cardiac ICU, which typically only had 2 to 3 cotties a year, had suddenly had 5 cotties this year. So I was so focused on them, I didn't realize how well my other unit was doing. So it's that spread, sustainment, and moving it forward. You're not always going to meet your goal, but it is that continued process and don't give up. So I'd love to say we saw that we haven't. But the lessons we certainly have learned here at TMC was, This cannot be just a one department. It has to be bought in by everybody. And nursing, we talked about some of the pushback from physicians, but really nursing owns catheters. 90% of it. Yeah, we get some pushback, but we can tell those physicians, hey, you know what, we can do accurate eyes and nose, or darn close enough truly that you will meet the expectations of the treatment of your patient. So when we bought in nursing into this program, that's where we really saw a change. I one of the early things I noticed that we could have done a little bit better was more notification to get the physician buy-in, but we certainly, having done this for almost 2 years now, they know our goal, and our, the buy-in has been much improved. Again, our nephrologists, however, I mean, still need to work on. But it is bringing all the stakeholders. As we implemented our products, we realized early on that we really didn't bring in our inventory management, all of our product people. So there's been a lot of work in stocking all the urinary catheters, the condom catheters, the change in the Foley kit for ER. So it's making sure you identify all those ancillary departments that you have to work with, and it's not just a single or two-unit-based program. And again, don't give up. This is a continual process. You know, we pull our hair out here once every other month, it feels like, but we do get we get moved forward. So thank you for your time, and this is my contact information. I'm more than happy to talk to anybody. I've had opportunity to share some of our product lines we've used, some of the resources we've had that we've been allowed to get in and help you. So thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you both, Linda and Jenny, for sharing this information. Just kind of a wrap-up, I think that you guys have provided this opportunity for hospital teams to think about their own organizational culture and how to improve the culture by utilizing components of this culture of safety model. So we do want to open it up for, we have a few minutes left, and both Linda and Jenny have said that they would stay a little bit late, so we understand if you guys need to drop off the line. Thank you for joining us today, but we are going to do a Q&A session here. So first, I think I'm going to read this question from the chat, and then I'll turn it over to the operator to give the instructions. So we had a question in the chat. Does anyone have any data on why not to bladder train? Kristen says her physicians won't have buy-in without some published material. So, and then, operator, can you give the instructions for Q&A while Linda and Jenny ponder that question?
Yes, ma'am. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. This is Linda. I don't, at my hands, have any published data. I do think, however, why some physicians are resistant, because really a bladder can only be trained to some extent. And oftentimes it's really influenced by the involuntary nervous system. And so physicians feel that, you know, that it may not be appropriate. So I will find certainly some information, but I think that that's where the discrepancy is, that oftentimes physicians feel that it's just not appropriate. It's involuntary nervous system. There is no way you're going to train it. However, you know, the literature shows that there are voluntary nerves that also may control it. And I think the problem is evaluating which patients are appropriate for that. So we'll see what other information we have, and we will post it in terms of any data that we can find. So, Jenny, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, actually, you know, that was one of the things we talked about early on in probably the first 5 months of our process is what, where does bladder training fit in on this? And frankly, we didn't find much literature to support yay or nay. In fact, it really was more like it really isn't effective. So I have to admit, we looked at that and we didn't go with it because, again, we didn't really find helpful literature to support any benefit to it.
Yeah, probably for the reasons I mentioned. So thank you.
Okay, our first question comes from Sarah Gabbard.
Oh, thank you. This is a side question. We are working on trying to make all the recommendations by CDC, and one of them is keeping a closed system. However, for some of their patient populations, they require intermittent irrigation, and using the side port is not effective enough, and we're having to open up the system and using a 60 cc 2-meter syringe to irrigate intermittently. Is somebody doing something different somewhere and finding success keeping a closed system?
Are you using a three-way catheter? This is Linda.
No, these are patients that come in and we just put the regular Foley in, and for some reason they end up with little clots and sediments and things like that and needing some intermittent irrigation.
Well, I was, this is Linda again, I was at an ANA conference and we had representatives from the Center for Disease Control there as well who were part of our panel. And they were very clear that if you have to open it up and you anticipate that there might be more irrigation, you should insert a three-way. If it's a one-time type of thing, then ideally you want to replace that catheter to maintain that closed system. And I know hospitals struggle with that, but doing intermittent irrigation is really certainly not something that you would want to do. So if you're going to have to irrigate, you know, on numerous occasions, then really the catheter should be replaced with a three-way.
Yeah, I mean, with the three-way, sometimes we have issues with clotting some of our transplant things, patients.
Yeah, this is Jenny here. I mean, there's one, again, we sometimes have to think out of the box and be creative, and that's what we do sometimes. I know when we do bladder scans or when we do bladder pressures, do you guys do bladder pressures there?
Yeah, we have to open up the system, too, for that sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can actually, I mean, because what we do is we actually hook up an IV system to that lure lock port on that Foley, and you can actually maintain a closed system because, you know, we instill 50 cc's to do a bladder pressure. So, you know, you could actually adapt that process. Again, ideally follow the recommendation, put three-way in. But if it's going to maybe two or three times, you could just put an IV bag on that one, put a three-way in, hook it to that side port, and you can leave a closed system and just put a 60 cc syringe on that. And that's one way to kind of work around it. But we've certainly, that's a style of system we've used to maintain closed system for when we do bladder pressures.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Our next question comes from Deborah Chiaffi.
Yes, hi, it's Debbie from New Jersey. I just had a question. We have been very successful in engaging our physicians and our chairs of our departments and also the director of surgery, and they are really supportive of us removing the Foley so we can move forward with our protocols. However, one thing came up with urology, and there were some concerns that surgery may have any patients that have, like men that have prostate issues, that they'd want to check before they remove a Foley on a patient that may have some difficulty if it had to be reinserted. Has anyone had any challenges with that population?
This is Linda, and Jenny may have as well, but what I can tell you is with the urology population, oftentimes it can be very unique, and they can have some issues in terms of difficult insertions or what have you. What we've done with our nurse-driven protocol is allow an opt-out of the protocol for patients with particularly difficult insertions or difficult urological problems so that, you know, the physician can opt out of that for that very reason.
Yeah, we tried to keep it very simple and only a few reasons, you know, long anesthesia, something, a spine case that takes very long, but this is the one they were okay with everything but the urology, so I was wondering. Okay.
Yeah, I would probably add something, patients with difficult or urological issues or something like that to cover that, because I know that is a challenge. I don't know, Jenny, have you had any of those issues in your neurosurgery ICU?
Yeah, definitely. In fact, that's kind of like our caveat on our protocol is if it's a urology-placed catheter, you don't take it out until you've cleared it with urology. So, yeah, we've given them kind of that free pass on those patients because of the challenges. But on the flip side, we've also found, and reminding our nurses, you know, if you got that patient who does have a history of prostate, you're better off not putting a Foley in because you can actually cause trauma. And that's where we run into trouble is because of the trauma from the Foley placement. And that's a non-surgical patient, let's say an ER patient coming in. We've caused trauma, which then make them where they rely on a catheter and the urology has to come in and put in the catheter. So, yeah, from surgery perspective, yes, we require.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Barbara Keller.
Yes, this is Barbara Keller from California. I have a question from this last speaker. What devices or hooks did they find prefer the MRI and CAT scan?
You know, I actually haven't been to MRI in a while. CAT scan, when working with our infection control manager, they're working on the hooks. We have we just have an IV pole in the room, and we have a little hook that can be adapted to the IV pole. So we could just put a pole next to the side of the bed, and then obviously you can't put a pole in the MRI room. I haven't been there in a while. But, in the CT scan, we just put it on the IV pole that's below the patient. MRI, I guess, be creative.
Again, to ask a question, please press star 1.
I just want to take a moment, make sure that you guys complete the evaluation from today's webinar. There's a link over in the left side of the discussion area. Go ahead and click it. We appreciate your feedback, and we use it to not only for our presenters, but also for the content of the presentations as well. And then I want to highlight some upcoming content webinars that we'll be having over the next few months, September, October, and November. Topics are listed there on the right side. And then particularly for September is going to feature Drs. Mohammed Faki and Nasia Safdar, as well as Ms. Kathleen Fletcher. And they're going to be talking about infectious complications that are related to the catheter other than Claudie. So tune in for that on September 9th at noon.
And we currently have no further questions in the queue.
All right. Well, I think we're going to call it a day. We're 8 minutes over. I appreciate everyone staying with us during the presentation today. If you do have other questions, you can always email us. I'm going to put our email also in the discussion area. Feel free to reach out and with any questions you have later this afternoon or throughout the week, we can send those to Linda and Jenny for follow-up. And again, thank you, Linda and Jenny, for presenting today, and thank you to all of our attendees for joining us, and we hope that everyone has a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.